This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Early industries that flourished in Connecticut included craftsmen who made clocks and watches in the 18th and 19th centuries. Do you have a Seth Thomas clock in your home? Coming up, we'll learn about that time in our state's industrial history with Patty Philippon, Executive Director of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol. Now, the point of wearing a watch may seem odd these days, given the fact so many of us rely on our smartphones for everything, including telling the time. Nevertheless, is watch making on the rebound? We'll meet a Vernon, Connecticut resident who believes so. Brian Dunnigan is a web designer by day and also co-founder of the Hawthorne Watch Company. We'll find out what inspired him to make watches. That's later. First, artisans need apprentices to keep a traditional art form alive. Is there a craft or style of art that was taught to you? You can join the conversation. 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive@wmpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. A new exhibit at the Connecticut Historical Society celebrates the importance of that relationship between masters and their apprentices. In studio with me is Lynn Williamson, director of the Connecticut Cultural Heritage Arts Program at the Connecticut Historical Society. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lucy.
So tell us about this exhibit, and who exactly are you featuring at the CHS?
The exhibit is open to the public right now until March 10th. And it featuring 13 apprenticeship teams, artists who have been part of the Southern New England Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program, which is a program based at the CHS. And it's pairing master artists from Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts with apprentices from one of the other states, because we like to see the communities knitting together across the state lines.
This program you mentioned, it's in its 20th year.
We are celebrating 20 years of the program, which began at the Institute for Community Research in Hartford. And so for the last 20 years, we have supported 142 apprenticeships, and a total of 464 artists have been part of this. We do receive wonderful support from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Connecticut Office of the Arts for this work.
When you talk about supporting these artisans, these apprentices, what do you do exactly to help them with their craft?
The apprenticeship program is one activity of the Connecticut Cultural Heritage Arts Program, and that program is part of a nationwide network of folk and traditional arts initiatives that look for, document, and support artists who come from a community-based artistic tradition. So I'm out in the field, I'm out throughout Connecticut, looking for artists, looking for community cultural expressions that are sometimes that fly under the radar, so we don't see them often, and yet the vibrancy of community cultural life is happening all the time all around us. So I'm looking for that, working with the artists to try to support the work that they do and keep the traditions going, but also to communicate what they do to the wider Connecticut public.
You mentioned the artists and their apprentices. Can you give us an example of who people will be seeing when they go to that exhibit? And what are the styles that they're teaching their apprentices?
We have had such a variety of apprenticeships within the program over the years, from many different communities, from many different genres and traditions, and many different ethnicities. We also feature and work with a lot of occupational artists. So, for instance, there are maritime traditions that extend all throughout southern New England, and we've had a wonderful apprenticeship with maritime knot tying and rope making. So a lot of the work ends up being very functional and very practical. It's beyond the artistic tradition itself. Also in the exhibit, we have Assyrian lace making. So the Assyrian community in New Britain is fairly large, and lace making is one of the wonderful expressions of learning and tradition that that community really values. There's also a wonderful example of Mohegan pottery in the exhibit. So that is an ancient tradition that has been revived by the Mohegan Nation. They brought in, through our program, a master potter who taught a tribal member how to recreate the Fort Shantok pottery that's so much of a place-based in Fort Shantok, which is a state park in Connecticut now. So they are now able to have the pottery that was so much a part of the traditions of the nation.
Because we're on the radio, I'm trying to envision what this would look like. What does this pottery look like?
The pottery is interesting because it's fired in a kiln, but it's a pit-fired pottery. So that's an ancient technique. The pots themselves are... You can really see how they fit into the Mohegan Nation territory because they use what's called a shell temper. So the people, of course, Mohegan lands live along the river. They ate a lot of the shellfish and then took the shell, ground it, and then incorporated that shell right into with the clay, and that makes the pot stronger. And there are also some very interesting castellated designs on the top that have a meaning. Often you'll see corn depicted, a tremendously important food for the Mohegan people, and sometimes faces. And so there's all kinds of symbols and mythology that goes along with this.
I'm speaking with Lynn Williamson, director of the Connecticut Cultural Heritage Arts Program at the Connecticut Historical Society. This is where we live, and this exhibit is at the museum right here in Hartford, celebrating 20 years of the Southern New England Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program. Have you participated in the program? Is there a style of art that was taught to you by a master artisan? We want to hear your story as well. 860-275-7266. On the phone with us is one of the participants of this apprenticeship program, Rodbel Varula, director of the Mariachi Mexico Antiguo Group based in Wallingford, Connecticut. Rodbel, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Hi. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you hear about this apprenticeship program?
Well, we were having a concert in, I think it was Hartford, for the Mariachi Academy, and Lynn happened to be there, and she approached me after the concert and asked me if I would like to be a part of the apprenticeship program.
Tell us how you started playing mariachi music.
Well, I started when I was in high school, and I went to high school in Las Vegas, so I'm kind of far from here, but they had mariachi programs in high school, and that's where I started my sophomore year, and after that, I've been playing mariachi ever since.
I'm sure many of our listeners have seen mariachi performed, especially when they go to a Mexican establishment or restaurant, but tell us about the actual ensemble and what you play.
The actual ensemble, so the ensemble is usually comprised of six violins, two to three trumpets, a harp player, a guitarrón player, which is what I play, and a vihuela and a guitar player.
You said a guitarrón. Explain what that is.
So the guitarrón is practically the base of the mariachi. It's kind of the heart of the mariachi. It's what keeps the tempo for the whole band so that they don't get off time.
Now, I understand you're teaching that now to a Connecticut-based apprentice. Tell us who your student is.
My student was Citlali Hernandez.
And is it unusual for a young woman to be playing the guitarrón?
Typically, yes. It's pretty unusual for a young woman to pick up the guitarrón. Usually, it's kind of like everybody says it's like a man's instrument and a man should be playing it. But I think it's great to see young women playing it, especially if they have the interest for it.
You said it's a man's instrument or seen that way because it's so large?
Yeah, because it's big and the way you have to press down and the way you have to pull with your right hand, it's kind of like it gives you a lot of callus over time. So that's why it's referred to as like a man's instrument and stuff like that. But I don't think that way, but a lot of people do tend to say that.
So you were teaching her to play the guitarrón. What are those lessons like?
Well, the lessons, they consisted of a bunch of things, terminology especially, so getting her into the Spanish terminology, because we do teach in English, but we also like to keep the tradition alive by showing them and telling them what the terminology in Spanish is, because say I were to invite a master teacher from another place, they would be speaking to them in just Spanish, and they would say, I don't like your jalón there, and jalón is basically the pull for your right hand. Or they can say like, oh, this song starts on segunda, and that would mean it starts on the second of that song. So little things here and there, that's what it consisted of too. And also formulas, A lot of the songs, especially rancheras and sones in mariachi, are based off of formulas. And she had a really hard time memorizing her music. And I told her to stop looking at it measure by measure, note by note. It's really based off a formula. So if you follow the formula, you'll end up being on the right track, and it won't take you so long to memorize your music. And also confidence. She wasn't really a very confident player in the beginning. But now she's starting kind of to break out of her shell and be more confident, and I get so nervous while she's on stage.
Lynn, this is an interesting relationship between, again, a guitarón, a master guitarón player, teaching a young student how to play this instrument. This is exactly the reason you have this apprenticeship program, to foster that development from many different art forms.
Yes, that's really true. And I had the opportunity to observe Rodbel and Zidlali teaching. The teaching under an apprenticeship is different from a class. It's usually in an informal setting. So in this case, the learning took place in Zidlali's home in Wallingford, where she could feel comfortable and where she could devote her full attention to the kind of things that Rodbel was telling her. And I watched her. She was focusing so much on what he was saying. And in many cases, an apprenticeship will begin with simple observation. And I could see that she was watching him very carefully. She was listening. And then she would try herself to do the playing of the guitarón. Sometimes Rodbel would sing and he would give her the tempo. And she really developed over the several months of the apprenticeship to someone who could perform with the group. And she did at the Connecticut Historical Society. We had an outdoor concert featuring the mariachi group last June, and Zidlali played an entire song with the group. And so that's really the goal, to prepare a young musician to play and be part of the group.
And through this program, are you providing stipends for the relationship so that someone can actually go to someone's home and teach them this craft so that they're getting something out of the time spent?
Yes. Typically in the program, we pay the master artist for his or her time teaching. And so the apprentice is receiving this instruction free because the master artist's fee is covered. And in this case, too, with Rodbel and Zidlali, we were able to help support the purchase of a guitarón for her because she had to borrow one before. And when she had her quinceañera, when she turned 15 last year, she received her own guitarón, and that's a major milestone in a young person's life.
That sounds remarkable, especially to be able to have this instrument that she has learned to play through this apprenticeship program. You mentioned that public performance, that's the goal, as you mentioned, once they go through the apprenticeship, to perform in public or to show that they're the craft that they've learned?
Yes, that is actually one of the requirements that we have, is that the performing artist showcase their learning in some kind of public event. It doesn't have to be a large-scale event. It can be a community festival. And the visual artists do demonstrations in public. They might have an open house for their studio, and then they also show the public what they have been learning.
We have a clip of that performance again. Zidlali Hernandez, the apprentice our guest on the phone, Rodbel Varula. Here she is playing at the Connecticut Historical Society with Mariachi Mexico Antiguo. I'm ready for the weekend now, Rodbel. do you plan on participating in this apprenticeship program again?
Yes. Unfortunately, I missed the deadline this time, so I did want to do it again. But yes, I plan to join again.
We heard Rebel talking about how he's originally from Las Vegas. Through this apprenticeship program, you, Lynn, mentioned some of the pottery that the Mohegan Nation has been teaching. But also, what are some other types of art that really reflect the diversity here in Connecticut, besides also the maritime tradition, the knot time?
Yes, we do love to have occupational apprenticeships, like in bookbinding or blacksmithing. And one of the, I would say one of our successes has been in stone inscription carving. So there's a master artist in Rhode Island, Nick Benson, who's a MacArthur Fellow and a National Heritage Fellow. He has a shop, the John Stevens Shop, that goes back to 1735, doing gravestones and monuments and memorials. He taught a young man in our program and in very intensive 6 weeks, where the apprentice actually lived with Nick and was every moment in the studio. So that apprentice, whose name is Jesse Marcellet, is now able and has opened his own shop in Cape Cod to do exactly the kind of work he learned. So I'm thrilled about that kind of thing. So that's an occupational tradition that's real New England-based. And we also have currently an apprenticeship with a Somali Bantu basket maker, folks who have come to Connecticut within the last 10 years from Somalia. Mm-hmm. And they are, the mother is teaching her daughter how to weave the kind of baskets that the community uses every single day.
I was thinking, when I moved to New England, I was always in awe of all the old stone walls that you see, especially throughout the woods and former pastures throughout the state. I'd love to find someone that could teach me how to stack and make those stone walls. It's harder than it looks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's both an art to it and a science to it. And we do see that with all our apprenticeships. It's more than art. There's ecological knowledge behind it. Community histories, community values, spirituality. Mm-hmm. So there's a wonderful cultural expression behind all of these art forms.
This is where we live. Eric's calling from Hartford. Eric, go ahead.
Hi, this is Eric Gaum. I teach world music at Trinity College, and I've worked with Lynn for several years on this program. And I just wanted to say the work that she does with this program is educational and beneficial on so many levels, and not only with, reviving and continuing traditions among groups of people is one thing. For people newly arriving in the United States, allowing them to get a foothold in American culture, and then also allowing them to share their culture with other people in so many different ways, not only through this program, but then they later go on for exhibitions at folk festivals and in public presentations. And I just wanted to put a vote of confidence and just acknowledge Lynn for the great in-depth work that she's done for all these years. She develops personal relationships with these people, and long after the apprenticeship process has finished, she maintains contact with these communities. It's really impressive work. And I just wanted to say that I'm really proud of the work she's done. And I think there should be more support for this type of stuff all around.
Thank you, Eric, for your call. That must make you feel good, Lynn, to hear about
your
impact.
Thank you so much, Eric. And I really enjoy bringing some of the artists to Eric's classes. And so that's the way we expand the cultural knowledge, goes way beyond just holding it within the community, which is very important as well, but then expanding it outward is great.
Again, there's a Passing It On Traditional Arts Apprenticeships exhibit that's already open at the Connecticut Historical Society. Lynn, tell our listeners where they can go to learn more. Also, more events to celebrate this 20th year of the Southern New England Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program.
Yes, speaking of expanding this outward, we have three events coming up where people can come to the Connecticut Historical Society to see some of, just first of all, to see the exhibit, which is going to be up till March 10th, and also on February 1st from 5:30 to 7:30, we have our opening reception. We will be featuring performers, which will include Albanian dance, Lebanese singing, and Portuguese accordion playing. And there will be demonstrations of Assyrian lace making, woodworking, and Somali Bantu basket making. So that's our opening reception, and please do come to that. Then on February 17th, we'll have a class in Ukrainian pisanki making, which is the wonderful decorated mm-hmm. eggs. We have a real master artist here, Father Paul Luniu, and he'll be teaching that class. And then we have a closing event on March 10th at CHS. All these events are at CHS. And that will be featuring artists, performers, and demonstrations. So chs.org will give all the information.
And we'll make sure that we tweet that out at Where We Live. Lynn Williamson, again, director of the Connecticut Cultural Heritage Arts Program at the Connecticut Historical Society. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Also, Rudbell Varula, director of the Mariachi Mexico Antiguo Group based in Wallingford. Rudbell, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. After the break, we hear from watchmaker Brian Dunnigan. The Vernon, Connecticut resident co-founded a watch company last year. We'll find out who inspired him to pick up this craft. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Do you still wear a watch? In recent years, several companies from Apple to Garmin have released smart watches. But I'm talking about a traditional watch that just tells the time and not your calories burned or the steps you've taken or the constant reminders about the latest emails and texts on your smartphone. Watches can be practical or rather ornate pieces of jewelry. Are they making a comeback? My next guest thinks so. Vernon resident Brian Dunnigan co-founded the Hawthorne Watch Company last year. His interest in watchmaking also has a family connection. Brian's president and co-founder of the Hawthorne Watch Company. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I understand that your company is based out of your home in Vernon, Connecticut.
Yes, it is.
And why start a watch company?
So my grandfather was a watchmaker, and I think I had this love for watches instilled in me from early childhood. So it originally came about because of a dream, which sounds sort of crazy, but it was a literal dream. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I had dreamt that I had made a watch with laser hands. And I sketched it down and fell back asleep. And when I woke up in the morning, thought, you know, this is a little ridiculous, probably not doable, but, you know, I'm a designer. Let me try and sketch some things out for fun. And that was sort of the initial concept for the company.
Some people say your best ideas come when you're sleeping.
Yeah.
So you really decided to take initiative and say, I dreamt about this. Let me see if this is something that I should do. Why the name? Explain the name Hawthorne Watch Company.
So we wanted to sort of tie in my grandfather into the story somehow. So my grandfather had a bench in his basement where he used to work on watches. And outside of the small window in the basement, there was a Hawthorne bush. And I thought, you know, this is a nice way to tie him in without calling it, you know, Bernard Watches. His name was Bernie.
When you look at people, oftentimes they're looking at their phone. They can see the time. They can check their email. They can post pictures to social media. Is there interest in purchasing and wearing watches today?
Oh, absolutely. I think the functionality of a watch or the need for a watch has changed. But I think people still like to wear them, right? You don't need a watch anymore to tell time. You have a phone, which is far more accurate than any watch will ever be. But it's still there for fashion, right? To tell a story about yourself. You can learn a lot about a person just by the watch that they're wearing. It's, you know, one of the few things, the few pieces of jewelry that men can wear that's socially acceptable or common. And I think it's a really good way to sort of tie a memory to a situation. You know, they're given a lot as gifts or for, you know, a graduation or an anniversary. So now you have this memory tied to this physical object that you can always wear around with you. So I think there's this still a love of watches.
You started a Kickstarter campaign to help launch this company. How did you sell this idea to people that you know and maybe even strangers?
Sure. I think the big thing for our Kickstarter campaign was keeping this whole project quiet up until right when we were going to launch, because no one had really any idea we were doing this, because we wanted this wow factor, right? Like, whoa, you made a watch, like, and it's here and this is it. So I think that was initially how we got family and friends in on it. Was like, wow, I can't believe you did this, and this looks amazing. You know, not to pat myself on the back. And that was sort of a bulk of the Kickstarter. But then the other thing was people who don't know about the watch. And that was, you know, telling the story about my grandfather and talking about how the materials are really high quality for the price point. And, you know, we wanted to offer something that was affordable but would last a really long time. So I think that's what helped sell it a lot when we were on Kickstarter.
You launched the company early last year?
Yes. It's almost a year ago.
You've mentioned your grandfather a few times, so tell us about him. So his name was Bernard Brown. Where did he live, and how did he get into watchmaking?
Sure. He lived in West Haven, Connecticut, and they also had a place in Florida, in West Palm Beach. And he worked in New Haven as a watchmaker, and he got into it. It sort of would start with World War II. So he served in World War II, and after he came out, he used the GI Bill to study watchmaking at the Waltham Watch Company. So that's where he got his initial training. You know, I'm not sure why he decided watches. I don't even know if my grandmother is sure why he decided watches, but, you know, he went for it. And that's sort of, you know, where he got his start.
Connecticut has a rich history in watches and clocks. And I'm just curious, was your grandfather the only one in your family that made watches?
So his brother was also a watchmaker. You know, I know less about his history of watchmaking. But yeah, there is something to do with watches in the family, just in our blood.
When you were little, you would watch your grandfather, Bernard, make these watches. What do you remember about that? I know you brought a couple of these logs that he would write in.
Yeah, it was the intricacy of his work. You know, all the gears and the springs and all the little pieces are so small, and you have to be so precise and so focused. And it was sort of fascinating to watch him work with such precision. And especially, like, you know, his logbooks, you can't see them, are incredibly well maintained. The writing is really, really small, but very crisp and easy to read. So it's just that precision to detail that drove me to this love of watches.
Because our listeners can't see these logbooks, you mentioned there's a lot of detail. What did he write in them?
Just about everything you could ever imagine, from, you know, the make and model of the watch to who owned it. How many jewels are in the watch, you know, what needed replacement, what he replaced it with, how much the part cost, how long it took him, you know, and then a few other notes here and there, just incredible amounts of detail.
And you inherited some of his tools. What do you need to make a watch?
There's a lot of things. You know, there's presses and specialized little tools to hold in your hand. And, you know, there's lots of little pieces. And I didn't realize I had this incredible love for watches until it was, you know, essentially too late. He had passed in 2011, and then my grandmother had moved in with my parents, and they sold or at least got rid of a lot of his watchmaking stuff. So there were tons of tools and, you know, his watchmaking bench and things that I look back and wish that I had and wish that I had held on to. But, you know, it is what it is.
You didn't start this company alone. You did have that dream, and then you decided to try making it, you know, to follow your passion. Tell us about your co-founder and how you're working together in this company to design watches.
Sure.
Today.
So I was trained as a graphic designer, right? So a lot of 2D stuff. And while I was in school, I made friends with a kid named Jeremy Crossgrove. He's an adult now. I shouldn't say kid. So Jeremy Crossgrove and I had become friends, and I remember sitting in class next to him, and we would, you know, design goofy things back and forth. And he had eventually left the school we were going to about halfway through to go to Mass Art to study industrial design. And, you know, he wanted to do more of the 3D stuff while I was doing 2D. So when I initially started the company, or at least, you know, started sketching this idea, I realized I had no idea how to make this a 3D object. I only knew one person that could do something like that. So I reached out to him, And he had been going through this period of absolute watch love or obsession. So it was perfect timing. As soon as I told him about it, he hopped on board and it just sort of took off from there.
What's that first year been like?
First year has been busy. It's been nerve-wracking, you know, not knowing where it's going to go, not knowing if it's going to be successful. But I think things are starting to slowly snowball for us. We're getting more busy. More watches are going out. We're working on more watches. So I think it's been a fairly good first year, and I'm looking forward to the next, you know, 50.
You're listening to Where We Live. In studio with me, Brian Dunnigan, president and co-founder of Hawthorne Watch Company, based here in Vernon, Connecticut. Brian was telling us that his grandfather was a watchmaker. He inherited some of his tools, and after he had a dream, he decided to start this company with his friend, Jeremy Crossgrove. Now, you also brought some of the watches that you and Jeremy have designed. Can you describe them for our listeners?
Sure. Our watches are a vintage-inspired watch. They are sort of a minimalist design, and we have two designs. One has inlaid hour markers, sort of a simple face, but really nice and elegant, and the second one has printed numbers on them. They have a date complication, which essentially just means it shows the day of the month. We have brown and black leather bands, stainless steel cases, a sapphire crystal, which is incredibly hard is the best way to describe it. So it's second in hardness to diamonds. So you're not going to scratch this unless you're rubbing up against diamonds, which is great. And yeah, we think this vintage inspired feel is a great way to go.
Who's your target customer? Who are the people most interested in purchasing the watch you design?
Yeah. So I guess our initial thought, it was going to be millennials, you know, people just graduating, let's say, college or getting their first job or celebrating a promotion and things like that. And while that is a large piece of who is buying the watches now, we've also found that the vintage designs appeal to an older generation as well, because it reminds them of something that they had in the past, just with updated materials.
So you go from the design process. Where are your watches actually put together? Where do the materials come from? And how difficult is that to source?
Yeah. So everything is essentially designed and engineered by us, and then we contract out different manufacturers for different pieces. So the watch movements themselves are made in Switzerland. The cases and the sapphire are milled in China, and the straps are made by a company that's headquartered in Florida, and the leather is tanned in Maine. So sort of all over the place, you know, we had to find all these businesses, and it all comes together to form, you know, this one sort of international watch.
Now, you still have your day job as a graphic designer?
Yeah, a web designer.
A web designer.
Yeah.
How are you able to balance that with this company?
Yeah, so it's a pretty good balance right now. A lot of the times, or most times, I'll come home from work, my day job, and then work on, Hawthorne, and do that for a couple hours and, you know, fulfill orders and things like that. And that seems to be working pretty well. Hopefully we get busier and busier where I'm not going to be able to juggle something or things like that. You know, ideally, I would love to do the watch thing full time. And I think that's the long term goal. But for now, I can handle it.
You've been doing this for a year now. When you look out at other people who are making watches, who have you encountered? What's the community like of people that are really dedicated to this craft and, you know, are taking time to make really unique pieces?
Yeah, there's a large watch community that I don't think most people realize. It's a lot of watch enthusiasts, a lot of people who are really, really knowledgeable in the watch world, and they mostly embrace a lot of new companies, and there are a lot of new companies coming up now. So it is a little bit of a challenge to sort of make a splash, but I think we're doing that. And, you know, there's forums where you can go on where people talk about watches and how they're made. There's subreddits on Reddit for the people who use that site that has, you know, 200-something thousand people who love watches following these. So
again, I'd mentioned earlier that Connecticut has a long history in watchmaking. What have you learned about the old industry and how you're incorporating that at all into your new company?
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize what a rich history Connecticut really has in watchmaking. You know, people know Timex, right? Timex is a huge player, and they've been around for a really long time. But there were you know, dozens of clockmakers and watchmakers in Connecticut previously. So I think that we're trying to continue this tradition of Connecticut, you know, creating watches and sort of bring it back here.
We hear often it's hard to start a business. What has been the most challenging thing for you, Brian?
I think it would probably be exposure. You know, you'd think with the internet, it's really easy to get your name out there. But if it's really easy for you to get it out, it's really easy for everyone else to get their stuff out there. So it's just markets can become oversaturated. So our main goal right now is to somehow cut through that saturation so people will see us.
So how are you doing that? Obviously, you use Kickstarter, an online platform to raise money to help launch the company. Now, what are you doing to get the word out about Hawthorne?
Sure. We've been going to watch fairs to sort of talk about it in person. We talk to watch blogs, which have been really nice to us and been writing up articles. We'll advertise on Facebook and Instagram. And one thing that's been working really well for us is that we've sent our watches to a couple of YouTube chefs, is the best way to describe it. And they do a lot of cooking videos, and you see their wrists a lot when they're working. So we thought we would send them some watches. And just in the comments of people going, hey, what watch is that, have been enough to drive a lot of traffic to our site and a decent amount of sales.
Do you ever encounter a young person who looks at your wrist and says, what's that?
I have. And I'm just like, oh, you asked the worst question because I'm just going to talk your ear off now. But yeah, that's happened. And we've seen our watches in the wild, which is something that's sort of crazy to me, is just seeing someone you don't know wearing your watch. And that's a fun encounter.
Are you planning to expand your company, and how will you do it?
Yeah, so we're working on a chronograph watch now, and that is a watch that you can sort of time things with as well as tell the normal time. And a smaller watch for, you know, smaller wristed men or for women. And we're hoping that the sales from that will drive enough traffic to us that we'll start growing larger and larger, and hopefully we'll have to take on more people.
The one other thing I wanted to ask you, Brian, again, you have a day job. When people think about following their dreams, it's easy to stick with the 9-to-5 job. It provides stability. What would you tell people who are listening who may have that, who may have had that dream and don't know yet how to launch it?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, there's always still time to launch, and it's possible to do both. You know, you don't necessarily have to go fully in on your dream right from the start. You can, you know, put your toes in the water and see how it goes. I would say just try, because that's what I did. I'm trying and it seems to be going well, so I'll just keep going.
Brian Dunnigan, president and co-founder of Hawthorne Watch Company, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we learn more about the history of clock and watchmaking history here in Connecticut. Have you been to the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol? The museum's executive director joins us after the break, and you can too. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, Jeanette Eliou's debut novel, Brass, is set in her hometown of Waterbury, Connecticut. On the next Where We Live, we'll talk with Jeanette about her book. It's a humorous yet bitingly honest story of a mother and daughter struggling to find purpose across two generations. We're going to talk with her about her book and her journey as a writer. That's tomorrow. Now, before the break, we heard from Brian Dunnigan, a Vernon, Connecticut resident, co-founder of the Hawthorne Watch Company. Watch and clockmaking was an important industry in Connecticut, starting in the 18th century. To tell us more, on the phone with us, Patty Philippon, executive director of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol, Connecticut. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if you have relatives who used to work in the watch factories found in the western part of the state, you can join the conversation, too, 860-275-7266. Patty, we were hearing from Brian Dunnigan about his inspiration to make watches today. He also mentioned that Connecticut's well known for Timex, but our watch and clock history goes back much further. Tell us why Connecticut? Why did this become such an important industry here?
Well, Connecticut has a really rich history in clocks and watches, really dating back to the late 1700s. And part of it was really because we had so many great natural resources here. You know, people would come, they immigrated from Europe They learned the watch and clockmaking trades in Europe, and it was really in a guild tradition, right? So you had a master clockmaker who would have apprentices. So when people came over and settled here, you had the rivers that you were able to use to transport your goods. You had the woods and that you were able to use for case making and later on for the movement making and things like that. So you had really all of the natural resources that you needed here, as well as the people with the skills coming to immigrate to this country and be able to teach other people as well.
When we're thinking about them making clocks and watches, what exactly were they manufacturing? So the movements, the cases, how did that get started?
So the early people who were making the clocks here in the, you know, in the late 1700s, you would have a master clockmaker who would actually make the movement itself. Some of them were made from brass. Later on, they went to wooden works movements. And then what you would do is then you would hire a clockmaker who would make the a casemaker who would make the cabinet for you. So these were fairly expensive propositions because a master clockmaker might make about between 12 and 20 movements a year, and these are for tall case clocks, which we now call grandfather clocks. And so then you would have to hire somebody else to make the case for you. So this was really, they were for the very wealthy people to have, and not many people had them.
I mentioned earlier in the show, there's an antique shop in East Windsor that I like to go to, and there's a whole room, and a lot of the old clocks and watches, there's a few Seth Thomas clocks. So this was somebody that started making clocks and watches. But before him, there was Eli Terry. Tell us about him and when mass production began.
Right. Eli Terry actually learned the trade through, he was an apprentice for someone named Dan O'Burnup, who actually had been in South Windsor, Connecticut. So that's kind of where that area becomes part of the clockmaking story. And Eli Terry had become, you know, he learned with the grandfather clocks, and he then in the around 1806 was challenged to learn to mass produce. He was working with some methods of mass production already, trying to use water power and unskilled labor to mass produce interchangeable parts. And he's not the only person who was trying to get all of these elements together, but he really gets them all together for the first time. So you could take a gear from an Eli Terry clock movement and put it into another Eli Terry clock movement. And that really changed the clock industry as well as other industries. It had a lot of lasting impact on the way we think of manufacturing today.
And Seth Thomas, what made him popular? He took this shelf clock concept that Eli Terry began?
Yeah, Terry actually worked with Seth Thomas trying to manufacture these timepieces. They were partners together. And so he learned the trade and worked in the same practices with Eli Terry and then went off. Seth Thomas was actually a carpenter, and he was one of Terry's apprentices. And so then he went off and did business on his own, worked in, of course, Thomaston, as we think of it today, Connecticut. And he's one of the most famous clockmakers today. People still think of his name associated with clockmaking.
This shelf clock, it made it more accessible, more affordable for people, no matter their background, to have one of these.
Absolutely. And they were sold by across the country by Yankee peddlers who would put them in their wagons, and they would take them all across the country, which, of course, at that time, the country was much smaller than we think of today. And they would sell them to people. And so you could be down in the southern part of the country, and you would see a Connecticut clock on someone's mantle. So Connecticut was really synonymous with clockmaking.
Patty Philippon, again, executive director of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol, Connecticut. So obviously, Connecticut clock and watch history, a part of your museum. But what are you focusing on? And for people who haven't been to your museum, and what are they going to see?
Well, we have been here since 1954 when we first opened our doors. And we have we really tell the story of American manufacture of clocks and watches. So we have 6,000 timepieces in our collection, and about 1,500 of them are on display. They're ticking and chiming as you walk through the museum's galleries. And we talk not only about the clock industry, but also about some of the industries that came from the clock and watch industries. So things like springs and brass manufacturing and gears and different other manufacturing aspects that really came from the timepiece industries.
You mentioned brass. I think of the city of Waterbury. And the Waterbury Clock Company factory.
Absolutely.
Who are the people that come through your doors?
We have visitors from all across the world, actually. We have a map right when you walk in, and we get people who are clock and watch enthusiasts. Brian had come to visit us a couple of weeks ago as well. And then we just have people who are general visitors who enjoy the history and learning about the history of the industry, the science and technology of the timepieces themselves. People might come in for the artistry of the clocks and watches if you think they're actually quite lovely, stunning works of art themselves. And so we get people who come in for a lot of reasons.
You mentioned Brian Dunnigan again. He was our guest in the previous segment, Hawthorne Watch Company. We were asking him the question of, you know, are watches becoming trendy again? Do people actually want to wear them? And is he the only one making watches these days, he and his co-founder in Connecticut? Who are some others?
Well, definitely there are other places who are doing different watches. I know there's definitely the Nagematic Watch Company, which is in Oxford, Connecticut, who are making watches here. There's companies in Detroit like Shinola who are making watches as well. It's definitely an industry, I think, that is coming back in popularity. People are wearing watches again, whether they're vintage watches, whether they're new watches, whether they're smart watches. You definitely see more people. It's not just a fashion statement. You know, obviously you use them as timepieces, but they can be a fashion statement, especially for men. And we see them more and more, and it's something that we're actually doing more with our interpretation at the museum as well, showcasing more of our watch collection because there is such a renewed interest in it.
We're getting a tweet from a listener, Rob, who writes, I have an old Hamilton pocket watch, yes, circa 1915. Where can I get it fixed?
Well, that's actually a very popular question that we get. I would say call the museum. We have a list of people who we know who are repairers in the area that we can definitely let you know where there's some people near you who can help you with that.
So, Patty, you're saying that people are becoming more interested in these analog wristwatches in the digital era where we have all these smartwatches coming on board?
Yeah, we definitely see people who are wearing not just wristwatches, but there's a whole grouping of people who like pocket watches, and you see people coming in wearing pocket watches again as well. So it's a fun full circle for the watch industry.
And there used to be the Timex Museum. That's no longer?
Yes, that closed, I think, about a year and a half ago now.
Is it difficult to keep a small museum going, such as the museum that you have? And we always hear from different museums that oftentimes, you know, getting people through the door, that can be challenging. But the history, the nostalgia of watches is enough to get people to come?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects to it. Part of it is the nostalgia, and it's one of the wonderful things that we hear all the time when people come in is they find a piece, whether it's a clock or a watch, and they have an immediate reaction of, oh, my grandmother had one that was like that, or I remember growing up and we had that in our kitchen, or, you know, something that just really strikes a chord with them, and a positive memory, and we hear that all the time. But I think it's also showcasing the relevance of the timepieces that we still have, and there is still a story to tell with them. And companies like Brian's, they are just the next phase of this industry. You know, it didn't end in the 1950s and the 1960s. It's just changing and evolving, and that's the next phase of the story for the museum, and that's a really exciting thing to be able to interpret for people as well.
The museum's operating on winter hours, open again full-time in the spring. What do you have coming up?
We are going to be opening up a watch case to keep along with our topic here, where we're going to actually be able to showcase more of our watch collection. We also have a special exhibition called Scandals and Scoundrels, and it's talking about some of the kind of darker side stories of the clock and watch industry.
Well, that sounds like another show.
Patty, I would love to.
Patty Philippon, again, Executive Director of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol, Connecticut. Thank you so much for that glimpse into our state's history. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Today's show produced by Senior Producer Lydia Brown. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Special thanks to Carmen Baskoff. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Learn more about the show at WMPR.org/where we live. And we'll be back tomorrow.